Jeremiah chapter 9, if you have your Bibles with you, and you're good Baptist, so I'm sure you do. Jeremiah chapter 9, and let me just remind us again the context here. This is after 609, so Josiah has died at the Battle of Megiddo, and it is after the Battle of Carchemish, where Babylon defeated the Egyptians in northern Iraq. The Pharaoh came back from that battle and put a quisling or a sympathetic Judean king on the throne. He took away the other king that only lasted 3 months and put his buddy on the throne. Think of the Russians taking over Poland and East Germany and putting sympathetic governments on the throne at the end, you know, on the throne at the end of World War II. Are you tracking with me as far as the similarity? That would be in 609, 608. 605 is when Nebuchadnezzar is going to come and take Daniel captive, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego captive, and takes many of the household of the king or relatives of the king and sort of kidnap them. And they were his insurance policy that the Jews would not revolt against him. Of course, that didn't work out so well, so he came back again in 597. That's when Ezekiel is taken captive, and about 10,000 Jews go at that time. They revolt again against him and side with the Egyptians. And like you've heard me say before, and I wanted to check, Tiffany, you were able to, you are starting? Yeah, thank you. Okay. You always do, but I just wanted to make sure. As I said before, when God wishes to judge a nation, he gives them foolish, stubborn, unwise. Are there more adjectives I can use without being disrespectful? Okay, see, I wasn't going to go there, Doug, but thank you. Thank you for taking me to the place I didn't want to go, right? But is that not a judgment on a nation? To let them go where they want to go. So, what happens then in 586, Nebuchadnezzar comes back, and he takes them all captive, and he wipes out Jerusalem, burns the temple down. Okay, so this text is taking place 2 years or so before the first deportation. There's a quisling. Does everybody know the term from World War II as a quisling? Can I teach you a new term? Okay. So when Hitler wanted to invade Norway, he had invaded Poland in 39, and he wanted the ore and the natural resources of Norway, because they were rich in oil and they were rich in ore, coal, and that would fund his war. So Norway, and it was strategic, because if you look at a map, Norway is here and England is here, so it was kind of surrounding England, right, to their east. And he invaded Norway, and there was a guy that was the prime minister or a leader in the country, maybe he was the defense minister, and his name was Quisling. And Hitler bribed him, and he gave orders as the Nazis attacked that confused the Norwegian defenses, and he basically turned Norway over to Hitler. So he would be Norway's version of Benedict Arnold, if we use that terminology. So basically what Pharaoh did was put a quisling. You can Google it and you'll get the terminology. But he put a quisling in charge of Judea, and that's the king. And this is who Jeremiah in chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11, it's before the first deportation, and he's predicting this is what's going to happen if you don't turn. Okay? So he is going to have honest lips, I've said this to you before, a compassionate heart, and faithful service. So in other words, he's going to tell the truth. He's going to have a compassionate heart in that he's not going to let them wallow in their sin. He is going to help them find a way out, which is repentance. And he's going to still faithfully serve. So he's not going to lie to them. He's not going to say, oh, peace, peace, it'll be all good. Remember we saw that last week? Everything is fine. You have the temple. You have the law of God. God will never judge you. No, he's going to say, no, I'm going to be honest with you. Judgment is coming. But he still has a compassionate heart. He's not angry at them. He's not mad at them. He has a compassionate heart, and he says, oh, that my head waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep night and day for the slain of the daughters of my people, Jeremiah 9:2. We saw that last week. But at the same time, he's going to serve faithfully. He's going to keep serving. And he's going to be hated as we move further along. We'll see that. So chapter 9 and verse 3, because we went to chapter 9 and verse 2 last week. And it says, and like their bow, they have bent their tongue for lies. The average American, statistics tell us, lies 9 times a day. I want that to sink in. They've done statistics on this, and I know there are lies and then there are statistics, right? So you can make statistics say about anything you want them to say, right? But a couple of articles were published a few years ago that I read. The average American lies 9 times a day. And here's the sad thing. I'm not sure that Americans, Christian Americans, are that different than the average American. And there's a lot of different ways we lie. We can knowingly lie, and because we want to protect our face, we've messed up, and so we hope they don't catch us, and we lie. We lie by letting, that's one way. We just out and out lie, right? We just lie. Then there's another way in which, you notice how when you ever, anybody ever been on a jury? Okay, so I have, and you know, you say, or I've been in a jury pool, let me say this, so they swear you in, right? And I've taken oath of office every time I every time I make a new rank, you have to do a reenlistment. And you swear in a courtroom to what? Tell the truth? Say it to me. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So the truth, but the whole truth. In other words, I can tell you the truth, but leave stuff out that makes me look bad. Right? That's a lie. The truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. I can add to the truth. Right? So, you know, a long time ago they came up with this thing, you tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It's easy for us to lie. To save face, to save position, to save ourselves. We lie when we're lazy and we get caught. I don't know about you, and when you were rearing kids, my daughter will be here for the morning service, hopefully, if Bentley ever gets up from his long winter's nap last night. But she'll tell you, in our family, it was double spanks if you lie. Because if you lie to me, I can't trust you, and trust is the foundation of all relationships. And my goal when I had my children was to have a relationship with them and transition that to be a friend as they hit adulthood. But if you lie to me, I never know whether you're telling me that I can't have a relationship with you because I don't know what the truth is. And especially with my son, and my son and daughter-in-law, and their two will be here for Christmas Eve. They're coming in this week. We're going to have 9 guests in our home. My mother-in-law is coming on Tuesday, and my son and daughter-in-law and 2 grandbabies. So I'm going to have 4 grandbabies, 4 kids, and a mother-in-law, and I said it was going to be controlled chaos. I'm not even sure it's controlled. I just think it's just pure chaos. And we're getting a family picture taken. Can you imagine trying to get 4 children under the age, 3 and under, for a family picture? That's going to be chaos right there. So anyway, we lie. We lie to protect ourselves. We lie. We leave things out. We lie. And in our family, we would say to my kids, if you know, tell dad the truth. You're going to get spanked right now anyway. But dad knows. I'm giving you a chance to be honest. Dad knows the truth. Don't lie to dad. And what I was just going to say is we went through some deep waters, especially with my son in high school. And the thing I praise the Lord about is that we taught him before he was the age of 5, you don't lie to mom and dad. There are significant consequences. And when we got into some pretty deep waters with him in high school, my son told the absolute truth. And other people involved, other teenagers involved, lied and lied and lied and lied to their parents. And my son told the absolute truth. And they lied about him. But he was like, Dad, I was wrong. And here's exactly what happened. And here's exactly what did. And when there was an investigation over what happened, my son told me the absolute truth, even though it made him look really, really bad. I told my son at the end of that, time, he was a junior in high school, I said, I couldn't be more proud of you today than I'd ever been in my entire life. Because even though I'm not proud about what you did, I'm proud that you owned it and you were a man and you told the truth. God says about them, he says, verse number 3, he says, they all lie. They and like the bow, they have bent their tongues for lie. And notice what it says. They are not valiant for the truth on the earth. They're not valiant. They're not courageous for truth. They're not valiant for truth. For they proceed from evil to evil, and they do not know me, says the Lord. Everyone take heed to his neighbor. And this is the point of trusting. They couldn't trust each other. I mean, have you noticed? Have you ever signed a legal document? Have you ever bought a house? You sign 8,000 pages, right? I mean, it's pages and pages. Why do we have, whatever happened to the America? Greg, you mind shaking my hand? I know you've had COVID. I've had COVID. So how many of you, when you were a kid, this was enough? Anybody like that? If I shook your hand, if I gave you my word, that was enough. If you want to see the decline in America, it's that we lie. We are the most litigious society in the world. If you have a relative that's a lawyer, I'm not being evil speaking of lawyers, but we have more lawyers per capita than any other country in America, in any other country in the world. Did you know that? Why is that? Because we all lie to each other. And they have to have pages and pages and pages. I mean, the famous one from my youth was the woman who sued McDonald's for $1.5 million, and this was years ago, because the coffee was hot. Anybody, well, okay, after the advent of Starbucks, Starbucks has invented, you pay me $7 and I'll give you cold coffee. I don't understand that at all. I do not understand millennials who, what the point of cold coffee? I'm joking, of course, a little bit, but you give me $7 and I created a need you had to have that you didn't know you had to have. So anyway, I just go to Target with my wife and sit in Starbucks, right? So anyway, everyone take heed to his neighbor. And do not trust any brother. Oh my goodness. Aren't we there in America today? I mean, difficulties that I've had with my new home, I've had to get on the phone and send email and get on the phone and send email, and it's under warranty. Get on the phone, send emails, get on the phone, send emails. I mean, some of you heard how they put in my front yard. I mean, I had to, time after time after time after time, go personally talk, drive in my car, send emails to get them to do the right thing by 300 square feet of grass, which is pull the grass out, level the ground because it was all torn up, and lay the grass. I mean, I told them at the end, I said, I would probably spend 60 hours of my time to get you to do 2 hours worth of work. And it was all covered under warranty. It's just, oh no, and they pushed me off with the hope that I would just eventually accept it. Well, I'm Scots Irish. So I'm not going to accept lying. I'm not. You made an agreement. I paid money. I expect you to. That's legitimate, right? I mean, that's. Notice what he says. He says, do not trust any brother, for every brother will utterly supplant, lie, stab you in the back. My kids love to watch Survivor Island. Anybody ever watch Survivor? You know, I hadn't watched that in years, and last night we watched 3 episodes of Survivor. What's the whole theme of it is what? Stab the person in the back, right? It's lying to each other. And they have a Christian guy out there. I'm like, how can a Christian go? I mean, it's entertaining television, but it's, I don't know. I mean, the whole point is you have to lie. To be the sole survivor, you have to lie. Notice it says, and everyone will walk with slanderers. Everyone will deceive his neighbor and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies. They weary themselves to commit iniquity. In other words, they lie so much, they're exhausted at how much they lie. For the first time yesterday, I went out and I got 11,800 steps in or something like that yesterday. First time in a month-ish I've gotten that much walking. Brent and I went out and walking. And I got to tell you, where before I had COVID, I was, you know, 20,000, 21,000 steps, lifting weights, not a big deal. I was tired after 12,000 steps yesterday, or barely, almost 12,000 steps. I was exhausted. Think of what the analogy is. They lie so much, they have to sit down, and they're tired. I've been lying. I'm exhausted from, it's as if they had been lifting weights and doing heavy labor, and they're exhausted. I mean, the lie, the metaphor that he uses about lying is, it's, they lie so much they're exhausted at their lying. They weary themselves to commit iniquity. Your dwelling place is in the midst of deceit. He says you just live amongst liars. If you've ever worked with a contractor, Gene is laughing because he's worked with contractors, right, in your business, don't you? The old adage, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. Right? I mean, when we were building our building, we had two contractors. We were building a Tri-City that, well, then it was a $30 million complex. Today it's a $40 million complex just because of inflation. But we had one contractor that stole $330,000 from us. And I had a wonderful business manager. I had three in my 23 years there. I had three business managers, all with master's degrees in business, all MBAs. And but the second one I had, when we built the building, was just an honest guy. I mean, he wouldn't take a pencil home that was the church's if it was, you know, he was just so honest. And we were doing the building. We started our own contracting company, and we were going to hire a general contractor licensed guy to oversee the project. But when we were, you know how they have to grade in the property. It was 14 acres, and it was 300. I still remember to this day. Oh, $350,000-ish dollars that he was charging to take the graders out there and get it all, you know, here's the building, and here's that building, and here's this building. Here's the water runoff. And without talking to me about it, my business manager, he said to him, he said, oh, I need the money up front. Well, you know, a lot of times a contractor, Gene, you know, will say, I need the materials up front, or you pay me 30% at the beginning and it's half done, I'll give me another 20%, and you do it like that, right? Well, this guy came to our business manager and said, I need it all up front, because I have to rent this and rent that. Anyway. He got a couple of vehicles out there, and it was really going slow, and I kept asking, when are we going to start grading? And there were a couple of big vehicles sitting out there, a couple of trucks, and he came to me about a month after he wrote the check and said, the subcontractor just took his mistress to Tahiti, and he had done the same thing with three other jobs he was on. And he took $1.5 million and left his wife and went to Tahiti with his girlfriend. We live in a country of liars. We do. What we as Christians need to be very, very careful of is we tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, because it's easy for us to be enculturated by society. It really is. Go ahead, Gene. Yep. And how many contractors do you work? And so in building that building and other buildings, we all know that contractors will get you into the building halfway and then walk off the job and start the next building so they can always have cash flow. And we were building that building as the economy crashed in 08 and 09. So you had contractors that wanted to be paid because they were taking the money from the next job to pay for this job, and they're taking the money from the next job to pay this. I mean, that's how many wicked contractors work, and then when the next job dies, they don't have any money to finish your job because they're taking the money from the next job to finish your job because they're taking your money to pay for the last job. Yeah, go ahead. Oh. Yeah, it's a sad. So here's what I will say. If I was an unsaved person or one of these, I used to be a Christian, I hate Christians, then they use that as And you're exactly right. There are a lot of people that put the fish on their truck or their van or their truck, and they are no more a fish than a dinosaur. And by that I mean they're no more a Christian than a dinosaur, right? So here's what I wrote. I said in your notes, I said, I honestly don't think Christians lie much less than the average American. In the thousands of hours and literally hundreds and hundreds of people I counseled over 30 plus years of ministry, the hardest part is figuring out when people are lying. They all lie. They just do. And I know you say, Pastor, you're so cynical. No, it's just the truth. And sometimes they don't know they're lying. I literally will sit there with a couple and listen to them describe an argument they have. And I'm like, were you in the same room? Were you really in the same room? Because it's like, I don't recognize anything from that argument. Your stories are completely different. So sometimes it's, we have told the story to ourselves in our head so much that we've come to believe that we're either entitled or we deserve it or they, whatever. We've told our story in our head so much that lying isn't, we've salved our conscience about lying. And I just am saying to us today, and I preach to myself, so please don't, you know, I'm not Moses on Mount Sinai coming down with the law, but being honest, the hardest part is they've told the story so many times they think their lie is the truth. Other people lie by leaving out any parts of the story that make them look bad. And other people just straight out lie so they won't look bad or to get what they want out of you. People, there are two kinds of people. People that use people for what they want and people that serve people for God's glory. So you say, wow, well, what about all the people, the Mother Teresa, let's say, that example, or people that really serve? Well, you understand, as my wife will say, they have to do that because that's how they work themselves to heaven. So even in their service, they're not serving for God's glory, they're serving for their own end. Because they have a work salvation. People serve others for one of two reasons. Either to get out of them a need they have, or God's glory. Those are the only two people. And you'll see that in marriages. You'll see that all over the place. In the notes, I already mentioned that my kids and their double spanks. Lying was the worst sin in our family because lying breaks trust. And without trust, you can't have a family. Jeremiah takes several verses. I left the word verses off. Sorry. To explain the damage that lying does to community. Lying in a family community destroys trust, destroys community. That's why I'm so adamant about lying. Lying is just horrible. Because you can't trust. Because then you spend your time, it's like your teenager tells you a story, and if you don't trust them, you spend so much time going back behind and trying to check out, are they telling you the truth? I can't tell you how many hundreds of hours I've spent with counseling when couples or a teenager tells me something, and I'm spending the hours behind them to try to check out their story, and invariably I find out the story wasn't true. And when you lie to me once, I will never trust you again. That's what I tell when people come to me for counseling. I say, look, do not lie to me. Do not lie to me. Just like what you said, Gene. Can you get this done? Don't lie to me. Because then I'm going to just spend so much time trying to figure out, are you an honest person? Right? Where are we with time? Let me jump a couple of verses further. He says in verse 10, I will take up a weeping and a wailing for the mountains, and for the dwelling place, the wilderness, a lamentation. So the wilderness would be in southern Judea, where David ran from Saul, 2 inches of rain a year. I mean, it's really desert. The mountains are 50 miles the other direction. So if you go from Jerusalem 50 miles north, you're into the mountains. If you go 50 miles south, you're into this no rain zone. So you go 50, 75 miles to the north, and you're getting 38, 40 inches of rain a year. You're in the mountains in Galilee. Go 50 miles to the south, you're getting 2 inches of rain. I mean, within 150 miles, what you have in Israel is northern Israel is affected by European wind flows out of the north, and southern Israel is affected by the winds coming off of Egypt and the Sinai in the south. So it's really a cross play between rain and dry heat. Okay? So he says, he's going to take up a weeping. Jeremiah says, this is 2 years so before the first deportation, he says, he is going to become a lament for them. Lamenting was a cultural activity that took place when people died. So they literally, in Jesus' day, in the Jewish history, they would hire professional lamenters. So they would hire people that were good at crying. We call them TV actresses. I mean, seriously, right? They're acting. They don't even know the person. They're just paid to cry and yell out. So he pictures a countryside devoid of any animals and a Jerusalem home to scavenger animals that eat the carcasses of the dead people and the animals. So in the Jewish theology, they buried immediately. Think of Lazarus. He died and he was in the tomb immediately, right? Jewish theology, they bury immediately. So a carcass being left out, we're going to see in a second, means there's nobody. It's a picture of absolute annihilation. Everybody's dead because there's no one. There's so many dead bodies. They don't have enough people to wail. They don't have any professional wailers because they're all dead. And they don't have anybody that can bury anybody because they're all dead. It's a picture in their culture of complete annihilation. And he says to them, I will take up a weeping and wailing for the mountains and for the dwelling place, the wilderness of lamentation. So in other words, geographically, the entire country, north to south, because they are burned up so that no one can pass through, nor can men hear the voice of the cattle. Both the birds of the heaven and the beasts have fled. They are gone. I mean, it's all the animals are gone. I mean, this is starvation. It's devastation. When an army would come and surround a city, and this is hard for us to imagine because we don't think in their logistics. It was a competition between the invading army and the army in the city who starved first. So you think, well, the army is on the outside. They wouldn't starve. Well, does anybody remember what the Tsar did to Russia when Napoleon invaded in 1814? Does anybody remember what he did? Go ahead, George. You got it. Scorched earth. So what did... The Tsar knew he had a lot of territory, right? And he started burning all the crops. Now, did his peasants die? Yeah, they did. They starved to death too, but he burned all the crops, killed all the animals, and Napoleon got to Moscow and he thought, oh, the Tsar will sue for peace. And what did the Tsar do? Nothing. Now Napoleon's going to have to retreat out of Russia in the dead of winter. Napoleon went into Russia with 600,000, the largest European army ever. He walked out of Russia with 150,000. He lost almost 500,000 men in that retreat out of Russia. The Cossacks attacked on their flanks and just obliterated the French army in the middle of the winter. This is the same kind of thing that an invading army can sometimes starve outside the gates, because if the people in the gates have burnt all the supplies and killed all the animals or brought what they could inside the city, that army can't go 50 miles to find food. They don't carry, it's not like us when they have MREs and logistic trails. So when you are an invading army, you have to make sure you have the logistics to feed your family and feed your army for 3, 4, 5, 6 months while you're besieging the city. But what he's picturing here is that because the Babylonians would come, they would just obliterate all the animals by eating them for the siege. Does that make sense? He says there's nothing left. Both the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field have fled. They are gone. I will make Jerusalem a heap of ruins, a den of jackals. I will make the cities of Judah desolate without an inhabitant. Now I will stop there. Can you imagine if I made a prophecy today and said New York City will be a den of jackals? Coyotes will roam Wall Street. Well, I guess they already do, but... You understand what I'm saying? What if I said, you know, if anybody, you old enough, Planet of the Apes? Remember when he's riding down the beach, Charles Heston, and he sees the Statue of Liberty sticking out of that iconic scene of the Statue of Liberty? It's sci-fi, right? It's science fiction. That's literally what he's saying is going to happen within a couple of years to the city, that around that city lived 1 million people. There aren't going to be enough people to care to kill jackals and hyenas. And remember, jackals, the animals that he says are going to be there are the animals that eat dead things. Jackals. So there'll be so many dead bodies that aren't buried that it will attract the jackals to eat the bodies of the dead people that couldn't get buried. I mean, the metaphors and the word pictures here are just horrific. And if you notice, the consequence is because they're liars. They're deceivers. So it's easy for us to think, oh my goodness, our country, you know, with all the sexuality that's so horrible in our country and this, that, and the other thing. But do you understand that in the context of all this horrible, these horrible prophecies, they're all falling because they lie. That's how serious God takes the eighth commandment. Don't lie. Yeah, Gene, go right ahead. Yep. I've said this. Yeah, go ahead. Yes. But isn't that a lie? It is a lie. It is absolutely a lie. I don't. Most of you remember. I got Dylan and Tiffany, our younglings there in the back. So I'll exempt them. But do any of you remember or were aware when we went off a gold standard under Nixon? Does anybody remember that? So I was a kid. I was like two. You know, some of you were 30 or 40. So I mean, I was joking. I'm lying. Yeah. No. Okay, listen, you stop preaching to me. Okay, that's how we're done. Yeah, preaching to yourself. I remember the discussion after that was over, after we went off the gold standard, because I was 63 baby. So I remember the discussion in the late 70s and early 80s. And Reagan, in 1982, our national debt was $350 billion. That's the entire history of our country was $350 billion. Today it's $30 trillion. Today it's $30 trillion. And I remember the discussion and reading about the discussion, because even after he went off the gold standard, there was discussion, should we go back on the gold standard, blah, blah, blah. And the reason we went off the gold standard was because of Johnson's Great Society program and the Vietnam War. Everybody was exchanging dollars for our gold, and the Fort Knox had lost half of its gold reserve in 6 or 7 years. We were soon going to be a country without gold. So Nixon takes us off the gold standard and we start printing fiat money. In other words, there's no backing for it. Never in the history of mankind has a nation been successful just printing money that doesn't have gold or silver behind it. It's never been successful. And the discussion then was this. It's okay to do this because no government in the future will ever just print an insane amount of money because the bond market will raise interest rates so far because they're anticipating inflation. The bond market will allow us to print money because it will stop us. Well, the Fed just creates money by doing a bond purchase program. That's what's happened the last few years, right? So they just didn't anticipate how entitled Americans would feel. But you're right. Just printing money, that's lying. Do you know that in the last 30% of the dollars that are in circulation around the world have been printed in the last 2 years? Did you hear what I just said? 30% of the dollars in circulation around the world have been printed in the last 2 years. If from an economic standpoint, and they're all amazed that we have PPIs, the producer price index, inflation last month was nearly 10%. In other words, what producers are being charged for goods and services went up almost 10%. So our inflation that we're feeling as consumers is at about 7%. That means that businesses are swallowing about 3% of inflation. How long do businesses swallow 3% of inflation? Yep. John, you're a CPA. Susan, you're a CPA. How long How long do businesses absorb 3% inflation? Not too long. Especially when their employees are demanding bigger and bigger wage hikes. Yep. So I'm just going to go back to say what I said before. Here's history in Jeremiah. When God judges a nation, he does it by giving them foolish, stubborn, they think themselves wise, and this time it's an exception. And it's not going to be an exception. So the joy is that Jeremiah lived through this, and God blessed him, and we're going to live through this, and we're going to live for the glory of God. We just have to make sure that we don't mimic the world around us and be liars, right? We need to be truthful, and we need